So, why do we as elders want you to hear this sermon on Darwin and Moses? Well, partly because I gave a talk on this. I gave a presentation at Glendale Community College about 3 weeks ago. And what it was is they had a town hall meeting on racism and white supremacy and what to do about this problem. And so I got the email saying, any faculty member that wants to participate, and I said, this is my time. And so I asked them if I could share something and said, yes, you can be a part of the panel. So I gave a 10 or 12 minute presentation, and the head of the sociology department, Dr. Moore, said to me, she said, I've never heard anything like this in all my 25 years of being here at Glendale. And I want you to address the entire college next year as part of our guest lecture series. So I thought, well, before I do that, I'm going to give you the sermon that I would give. I'll change it, obviously, for the secular audience, but some of the material that I will deal with and draw from, I'm going to share with you today, because I want our young people, but I want you as parents also to be fully cognizant of what this theory of evolution, and especially not just the theory of evolution and things evolving or God taking time, is perfectly, there's many, many believers, evangelicals, who believe that God took over 5 billion years to produce the world that he did, and that's not the issue. It's the issue, what Darwin was after was that there was no God, and that all came from random forces, and it's just chemical reactions happening randomly, and that there's no meaning to this universe except that we're here, and matter has been here always, and there is no initial cause for this effect. That is what I'm criticizing. So we call this Darwin, Moses, and the Origins of Racism. So I'm going to deal not so much with the scientific questions about evolution. In fact, not at all. I'm going to deal with the ethical implications of evolution, Darwinism evolution, not just theistic. Theistic evolution is saying God used certain processes of evolution to create the world that he made today, but I'm dealing with non-theistic, just random, absolutely God, without God, evolution the way Darwin saw it in the beginning. So number one, I've got, I think, 10 points for this message. Number one is Darwin's belief in evolution resulted in white supremacy, the notions of white supremacy. In 1859, Charles Darwin published his seminal work entitled, in its original, The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Jim Rogers, that was the original title. It was a long title. We never hear the whole thing. We only hear Origin of Species, but it actually says the preservation of favored races in the struggles for life. So who are the favored races? As we learn from the later book, The Descent of Man, which was published in 1871, the most favored race was the Caucasian. The more inferior, or what he called savage races, he considered to be the less civilized Aboriginal tribes of Australia and the Americas, and especially Africa, whom he viewed as closer to the ape in development. When describing the process of evolution over millennia, Darwin wrote these words, "At some future period, not very distant as measured by centuries, the civilized races of man will almost certainly exterminate and replace the savage races throughout the world. The break between man and his nearest allies, that is, species-wise, will be wider, for it will intervene between a man in a more civilized state than even the Caucasian, if you can believe that, and some ape as low as the baboon, instead of now between the Negro and the gorilla." So Darwin saw baboon, gorilla, Negro, Caucasian. That's what evolution did. And these two, the Negro, the black man, and the gorilla would die out, and then there would be a greater chasm between something even better than Caucasian and the baboon. It's perhaps no accident of history that during the same time period, from the 1866 through the 1970s, the Ku Klux Klan began to flourish in the southern states of the U.S. Darwin's theory of evolution played directly into their hands. Number two, Moses' claim of creation resulting in one single human family. In contrast to this theory, Moses claimed that all the earth's tribes stemmed from one single family, beginning with Noah. He says, "The sons of Noah who went forth from the ark were Shem, Ham, and Japheth. These three were the sons of Noah, and from these the people of the whole earth were dispersed. So this would be like saying it's maybe not a coincidence. We have three kinds of people today. We have Mongolian, Mongoloid, Negroid, Caucasoid. We have yellow, white, or black. That's it. That's the only kind of people we have today in the whole world. And maybe it's because they were originally from one family. This claim was further elucidated by the Apostle Paul when he addressed the men of Athens, saying, "And God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on the face of the earth, having determined allotted periods and the boundaries of their dwelling place," or places. So the Apostle Paul is reiterating what Moses said. It started with one man. Of course, it started way before then with Adam and Eve, but once the flood came, then God was starting over again, right? So there's this thing that people call, the scientists call this thing called the most recent common ancestor of all human beings on earth. When did that person live? The MIT researcher, Dr. Douglas Rode from MIT, says that the MRCA is calculated as between 5,000 and 15,000 years ago. That's when that person lived, that couple, mom and dad. And he pointed out through two different models that we all have the same DNA, and it all goes back to that one couple, and there is nobody on earth that does not have their DNA, that we share one ancestor, whether we are black, yellow, or white. So to me, what's interesting is that the evolutionists keep wanting to, they want to ignore this. If you look at Britannica, they have this long, Encyclopedia Britannica has this long article proving evolution is true, but they never mention Rhodes' research. That we, wait a minute, we have one single pair of people that are our ancestors as not 314,000 years ago in Africa, it's 5,000 years ago in Mesopotamia. So number three, the source of Western civilization's advancement. If Darwin's view is correct, then the Earth's various tribes are not equal. Looking back at history, the relative advances of and the success of Western civilization should be attributed primarily to the superior DNA of Europeans. That's what Darwin would say. The reason that Darwin was so civilized is because Darwin had better DNA. And the people of Africa and the Americas, well, they're our forefathers, they're our ancestors that are a bit wild and uncivilized and, in fact, savages. And they'll be replaced soon. But if Moses' claim is correct, then all the tribes on earth are equal in worth and in ability. And then any human advancement will stem, that is like the Western civilization saw in Europe, the advancement of the Europeans and so forth, that would stem from access to God's revelation and his ways, not from any genetic advantage or refinement. So we encounter a telling narrative from Darwin's vast journeys around the world. Now you might remember, here we have Christian. Christian is from Ecuador, and he just told me, he reminded me this morning that next to Ecuador, it's not Central American, it's South American, right, are the Galapagos Islands. And that's where Darwin saw the finches there's a lot of what Darwin said is absolutely true. As the finches migrated to another island, their colors changed, the birds got, you know, this wing got longer, that beak got shorter, whatever. Things changed over time because God has put inside all the species the ability to adapt to its environment. That's why if you look at canines, the canines in the North Pole or up there, you know, they're all white, right? And bears are white. There's a polar bear, and there's a brown bear, and there's a black bear, and there's all, you know, it doesn't matter what your species are. You've got the different shades to go according to, adapt according to the amount of sunlight. I just happen to be very happy that I have some Mexican blood in me, because otherwise I'd be like my other friends and Anglos who are in the wrong place, right? They come from Scotland, they come from Scandinavia, and they come here to California where it's too hot. We weren't adjusted to this place, right? So we get skin cancers all over the place. Like my father-in-law, Harry, mom, he had skin cancers, and they went in there with nitrogen, you know, just zapping his skull because he was as white as a ghost. And I have one great-great-grandmother from Guadalajara. Thank you. That's why I still have my tan. I'm part Aztec. My girls even thanked me. She said, "I'm so glad, Daddy, that you had that grandmother, because look, we have a little, you know, yeah, you're right. Janelle looks like she's part, you know, Latina or something." So we encounter this telling narrative from Darwin's vast journeys. He went past the Galapagos and he went all the way to the tip of South America. This is back in 1836, is that right? he encountered a group of native men whom he called the Fuegians. This is at the very tip, right? After the Tierra del Fuego. And this is what he writes in his memories of them. He says, these men were absolutely naked and bedaubed with paint. Their long hair was tangled, their mouths frothed with excitement, and their expression was wild, startled, and distrustful. They possessed hardly any arts, and like wild animals, they lived on what they could catch. They had no government and were merciless to everyone who was not of their own small tribe. I would as soon be descended from that heroic little monkey or from that old baboon as from a savage who delights to torture his enemies, offers up bloody sacrifices, practices infanticide without remorse, treats his wives like slaves, knows no decency, and is haunted by the grossest superstitions. If you're a Darwinist, you don't have much compassion for a tribe of people that are not developed like you. He had utter disdain. The interesting thing is, most people don't realize that on that ship, the HMS Beagle, there was captain, there was the naturalist, Charles Darwin, and there was a missionary. He was the father of the Patagonian mission, John Bridges. We don't realize that there was actually several people on that boat that got access to these Fuegian men. And this other man who saw them saw a completely different society. John Bridges stayed there. He spent his life with the Fuegians. He raised his child, his children there, Lucas Bridges. And Lucas grew up knowing the Fuegian language. And then he later on wrote about his dad and wrote about Charles Darwin. So this is what Lucas wrote. He said, the belief that the Fuegians were cannibals was not the only mistake that Charles Darwin made about them. Listening to their speech, he got the impression that they were repeating the same phrases over and over again, and therefore came to the conclusion that something like 100 words would cover their whole language. Oh, these savages. They didn't make any sense. Well, they learned English. They got three young people on the ship, and they taught them English, and then they could speak. And so Darwin at least could see they could learn their British language. But we who learned, he goes on to say, we who learned as children to speak Yagan, because the people don't refer to themselves as Fuegians. They didn't know who Fuego was. They're the Yagan tribe, right? They had their own name. And he said, we who learned as children to speak Yagan knew that within its own limitations, it is infinitely richer and more expressive than English or Spanish. My father's Yagan dictionary contains no fewer than 32,000 words. And he goes on to say, they have 6 words for the word beach. They have 5 words for the word snow, for snow. They have all these very special words that they developed because of the environment they lived in, and they did very well. Of course they were savages. Of course they didn't have the gospel, but it's not because they had bad DNA. It's because they were without the gospel for centuries, like England had it before Darwin ever lived. In fact, this is most interesting. The condition, number 4, is the condition of the British Isles before the gospel. So if Darwin had taken some time to ask the question, now wait a minute, what were the Caucasian people acting like before, like B.C.? Well, how about 2,500 years ago? Were we acting similarly to this tribe of the Fuegians, or were we very erudite and gentlemanly, polite? Julius Caesar came into the British Isles in 45 B.C., and he describes the Druids, the Druid priests who lived there with the people, and it says that he was serving there as governor of the Roman province of Gaul. And this is from his journal. This is what Julius Caesar said. The whole Gallic nation is virtually a prey to superstition. Oh, wait, that word superstition. Oh, that was back here. I see it here too. They're so superstitious. And this makes the serious invalids and those engaged in battle or dangerous exploits sacrifice men instead of animals. They even now immolate themselves, meaning burn themselves to death, using the Druids as their ministers for this purpose. They feel that the spirit of the gods cannot be appeased unless a man's life is given for a life. Public sacrifices are the same sort, they're in common, are commonplace. Another practice is to make images of enormous size with the limbs woven from willow trees, and then they take living human beings and they're fitted into these, and when they are set on fire, the men are engulfed in flames and perish. The general feeling is that the immortal gods are better pleased with the sacrifice of those caught in theft or robbery or some other crime, but if a supply of such criminals is lacking, then they resort to the sacrifice of completely innocent victims. This is Great Britain before Christ. Like Darwin, anyone who considers his race to be the favored one will look upon others with disdain and have little compassion for those that are less fortunate. So I just want you to understand something. When he was thinking that, like he said, man has no separate kingdom, he acknowledged that theologians said there's always three kingdoms. There's the kingdom of plants, then there's the kingdom of animals, and then there's the kingdom of man. We have our own kingdom. We're not part of the animal kingdom, even though we are physically related to them, even though genetically we share 98% of what a chimpanzee shares. Fine. You can take a baboon heart and put it inside of a girl and save her life. But we have a kingdom because we are made in the image of God. There's something about humankind that makes him infinitely more valuable than all the animals in the world. And Darwin said, no. Man does not have his own kingdom. He is just an animal. He is much smarter. He's a lot more brainy, but he's just an animal. No different. So what I want to show you is from two books. I haven't bought them yet, but from reading the introductions to them and what people, other professors of history have said about these books, I plan to get them and use them and research them and polish my presentation. But I want you to see what happens when you say man is only an animal, because the result is they will act like an animal in the end. If that's all we are, then we can act like animals. We can kill without remorse. We can eat. We can be cannibal. We can do whatever we want to. There is no more right and wrong. Like David said in his sermon, Dostoevsky, right? If God is not, there is no morality. Nothing. You have nothing to base it on. Of course, today, most evolutionists do not share Darwin's racism. But many races today embrace Darwinism. Many races today embrace it. Number five, the development of racism in Europe. There's a book called From Darwin to Hitler, Evolutionary Ethics, Eugenics, and Racism in Germany. Eugenics, what does that mean? EU stands for good. So that euthanasia, good death. Eugenics, good genes. These people have good genes. Those people, bad. So Richard Weikart, professor of modern European history at California State University, Stanislaus. I just smiled when I saw that and realized I live in a state that is so anti-God, but there's a few people left right here in the Cal State system who agree with me, not just with me, but I mean agree with the scriptures on this issue of evolution. Richard Weikart explains the revolutionary impact that Darwinism had on ethics and morality. He demonstrates that many leading Darwinian biologists and social thinkers in Germany believed that Darwinism overturned traditional Judeo-Christian ethics and the Enlightenment and ethics of the Enlightenment, especially those pertaining to the sacredness of human life. Many of these thinkers supported moral relativism, yet simultaneously exalted evolutionary, quote, fitness, especially in terms of intelligence and health, as the highest arbiter of morality. And Weikart concludes that Darwinism played a key role not only in the rise of eugenics, which is like we have to keep our genes clean, not a drop of Semitic people will be among us, not a drop of black, not a drop of American, you know, meaning Native American. Darwinism played a key role not only in the rise of eugenics, but also in euthanasia, in infanticide, in abortion, and racial extermination, all ultimately embraced by the Nazis. He convincingly makes the disturbing argument that Hitler built his view of ethics on Darwinian principles rather than nihilistic ones. And there's another book. The other book is called, number six, is The Development of Racism in England and America. And this is a book called The Darwin Effect by Jerry Bergman. The Darwin Effect, he says, the title is called The Darwin Effect, Its Influence on Nazism, Eugenics, Racism, Communism, Capitalism, and Sexism. And John Woodmarop wrote this: Darwinism created an explosion of practical racism that had not existed before. Referring to the author of the book, Bergman writes, it is primarily between 1870, right after Darwin's book, and 1900 that educated Americans moved toward a wide acceptance of varying forms of eugenic-based racism. The long-term racist impact of Darwinism on public policy cannot be overestimated. Bergman comments, I didn't know this until this yesterday. Major Leonard Darwin, Charles Darwin's son, was the president of the British Eugenics Society. Imagine that. Like father, like son. From 1911 to 1928. The impact of the eugenics movement on American law was especially profound. In the 1920s, Congress passed numerous laws intended to restrict the influx of inferior races. That's what they referred to them as. Including those from Southern and Eastern Europe, as well as China. Eugenic beliefs were also reflected in everything from school textbooks to social policy. American blacks especially faced the brunt of these laws. Interracial marriages were forbidden by law in most states and discouraged by social pressure in all states. Karen reminds me, California did not escape that. Karen grew up in Burbank, and she remembers when she was young that any people of color had to leave Burbank by 5 p.m. They had to be gone before dusk. There was a racist town right in our midst, right here. Number 7. Enough of Darwin. What does Moses say about the tribes of the earth? People from the Americas, from the African continent, from Asia. We encounter a very different theology and philosophy. Moses tells his people, when a stranger sojourns with you in your land, you shall not do him wrong. You shall treat the stranger who sojourns with you as the native among you. As the native among you. And you shall love him as yourself. Incredible. What he's saying is you need to own up to the fact that he is your brother. As long as he's a human being, he's part of the original family. He is not to be treated like second-class citizens. For you were strangers in the land of Egypt. Don't you remember what it felt like when you were in Egypt and you were slaves and you were mistreated? Do you really want to do that to other people in your land? I am the Lord your God. You will not treat people like that. Later on, he says, circumcise therefore the foreskin of your heart and be no longer stubborn, for the Lord your God is a God of gods and Lord of lords, the great, the mighty, and the awesome God who is not partial and takes no bribes. He executes justice for the fatherless and the widow, and he loves the sojourner, giving him food and clothing. So therefore, love the sojourner. Therefore, for you were sojourners in the land of Egypt. Again, he mentions that in Deuteronomy, Exodus, and all throughout his writings. Let me tell you what Moses says concerning the handicapped. You know the famous passage in Exodus. Moses says to God, you chose me to be the leader. Oh, my Lord, I am not eloquent, either in the past or since you have spoken to me, your servant, and I am slow of speech and of tongue. And the Lord said to him, who has made man's mouth? And who makes him mute or deaf or seeing or blind? Is it not I, the Lord? The Lord takes responsibility for every handicapped individual, and they are to be treated the same way. In fact, he called someone who felt like he was handicapped and said, you're plenty good for me. I will use you to lead my people out of Egypt into the promised land. No, don't worry about it. I'm the one who gave you that impediment in the first place, and I'll be with you. That's all you need. And Paul later tells us that there's not many people in the church in Corinth who are high and mighty and well-educated, very wise according to man, and very rich according to people, or very wealthy, or celebrities, or whatever. No, he said, most of you are common, ordinary people, like people in Alhambra. Why? Because God loves to take the lowly and take those who are considered foolish by the world standards and shame the wise, and take the weak and shame the strong, take the poor and shame the rich. He loves to do that. So what does God say about the poor? What does Moses say concerning the poor? He says this very interesting thing. If among you one of your brothers should become poor in any of your towns within you that the Lord your God is giving you, you shall not harden your heart or shut your hand against your poor brother, but you shall open your hand to him and lend him sufficient for his need, whatever it may be. That's why in the early church, the church became like another repeat of the nation of Israel, only in a much more powerful and a much more spiritual way. The early church took care of everybody. That's why maybe some of you who have been under churches, I'm used to being in churches where you have to pay for, if there's a meal, you pay for it, or if you go on a retreat, you pay for it. And you know what? At Gateway, so far, the last 3 years, we haven't had to charge anybody for any retreat and anybody for any meal. The luncheon's on us. I mean, it's on God. It comes through your generous giving. And we loved it. It says there in the Jerusalem church, they took care of you. The widows were taken care of. They had food every day for the widows. In fact, it was such an important thing on the heart of God that he's and the heart of the apostles that said, look, if anyone has any need neglected, then we're going to appoint special men just to take care of that. And that was Stephen and Philip and those first seven deacons. The Lord loves the poor. Number 10, the teaching of Moses concerning slavery. This is a good issue to discuss today. If your brother, a Hebrew man or a Hebrew woman, is sold to you, that means because they're so poor, they're bankrupt, they can't afford it, okay, they'll sell themselves as a slave, right? He shall serve you 6 years, and in the seventh year, you shall let him go free from you. And when you let him go free from you, you shall not let him go empty-handed. You shall furnish him liberally out of your flock and out of your threshing floor from the grain that you have and out of your wine press. You load him up with lots of grain. You give him lots of, you know, plenty of flock so that he can start and live on his own. And even wine. He should have a couple of jugs of wine to take with him to celebrate life with. As the Lord your God has blessed you, you shall give to him. You shall remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord your God redeemed you. Therefore, I command you to do this today. Chalk up a nice severance for this guy. Come on, he's worked for you for 6 years. One of the biggest joys among the elder body was when Steve Walker said, I'm quitting on February 1st. I'm going to try to get a job at Home Depot. And we wrote him a letter and said, no. You've got a full pay for 9 months. You don't have to worry about anything. We want to give you not just a severance. We want to give you something that you can take a rest and take a vacation. Go to Alaska. And remember, we took up $5,000 and we sent them to Israel. That's the way to treat someone who's leaving. That's how you let them know your labor has been valuable. It's a treasure to us that you started this church, that you were here, that you were giving up 50, 60 hours a week for these people. You deserve it. And he had tears streaming down his face. He said when he read the letter, he was shocked. Alejandro gave him the letter, said, this is what it is, and your medical coverage, you're covered completely. We don't even want a copay from you. I don't care when you go. We're going to take care of everything until the end of the year. And during that time, God called him to Germany, and by the time he left for Germany, he had everything he needed. Moses and Darwin were poles apart. If there is no creator, then why do we have jails for criminals? What's wrong with someone shooting someone else? Darwin said the survival of the fittest, the one who's strongest should survive, the weak ones should die off. You know, in every single society before Christ came in, before the missionaries arrived, I don't care if you look at Hawaii. Hawaii, you think is a paradise, right? You should read what Hawaii was like before the first missionaries came. Like I told you before, in every single society untouched by the gospel, the women are mistreated. Every last one. It's a universal principle. It doesn't matter what continent you're on, Asia, America, or the islands, the women are mistreated. The weak are mistreated. And in Hawaii, the women were not allowed to eat, of all things, bananas, the best fruit on the island. They were forbidden, taboo. And I talked to a woman, an aged woman in Hawaii, who was the daughter of a missionary who was there, and said, you know, I remember when I was young, or my parents told me about a girl who ate a banana and her father gouged out her eye. probably happened in maybe the late 1800s or so, but it still was going on. They could not eat pork, they could not eat bananas, and if they did, they were killed or they had their eyes gouged out. And when you hear, there's a tract that was written by one young man. He was a teenager at the time, and he saw, I think it was Captain Cook or one of the early, it wasn't even a missionary, it was just a Western boat that ship arrived, and it had been 1400 years or 1700 years, something like that, where they had no contact with anybody. And this kid said, can I go on that ship? Can I help you guys? And so they took him aboard, and he learned, you know, the language. I guess it was English. He ended up in Boston, and then he went to Harvard, and he became a Christian, and then he found out about the gospel, and he said, oh my gosh, my people need this message. And he begged the churches in America to send missionaries to Hawaii, because he said, I'm telling you, our people are completely crippled with their ethics. Our older people, when they get to be old, like you, Mom, they just take them and throw them into the river, because they're not functional anymore. We don't need them anymore. Time to go, you know. Exactly how Darwin described the Fuegians. That's exactly what was going on in Hawaii. It doesn't matter if you're in Britain or in Point Fuego or in, you know, Hawaii. It doesn't matter where you are. If there's no gospel, there is no redemptive heart of man, and man will go on. The strongest will survive, and they'll kill off the weaker ones. And you have social Darwinism. And it is chaos. It is the worst thing that could happen to a society, to let the strong lead out and let the weak die off. Moses says, you will not treat the poor that way. You will not treat the widow that way. You will not treat the orphan that way. And you will not treat the stranger that way. Anyone who's on the weaker side of society, you will treat them and love them as yourself. Because you too were at that point before. You know what it's like to be poor, to be a slave, to be mistreated. So I have not dealt today with fossil evidence and all that stuff. I'm not going into the scientists. I just want you to see the ethics of Darwinism. Just the ethical part. And see the ethics of Moses. Either we came from apes and we're all animals today and we have no regard for anyone else. We don't owe anyone our time or money or anything. Or we all came from one family and every single person on earth is our relative. And we owe them the gospel. Let's pray. I thank you, God, for the power of your word. The truth that emanates from these pages, God. And our hearts cannot help but resonate with the truth. We too, Lord, know what it's like to be oppressed by someone or mistreated or a victim of someone's hatred or bigotry. So help us, Lord, to embrace the truth of your word. Help those of us who are in school or in college or in high school and we're thrown this evolutionist theory that says we're just basically animals, then there is no God, there is no creator, there's no meaning to life, there's no story of redemption, there's no purpose other than to eat and to go through life and then to die. Lord, help us to stand against that with the truth of your word and embrace it with all our hearts. In Jesus' name.